From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Dorian is making its way north just off the Atlantic coast today after decimating parts of the Bahamas. It's still a Category 2 hurricane, still very dangerous. We do need a weatherman to know which way this is going. So let's bring in Ray Hawthorne, meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Ray, where is Dorian now? Where's it headed?
Hey there, Robin. Well, right now the hurricane is about 90 miles to the east-northeast of Daytona, about 200 miles south of Charleston. It is moving toward the north-northwest at around 9 to 10 miles per hour. Hurricane warnings continue from Savannah to the Carolinas. Tropical storm watch is as far north as the Delmarva Peninsula. And we are expecting conditions in the Carolinas to go downhill a little bit later on today, all the way into Thursday. Conditions may not improve until Friday morning.
And how confident are you of this track?
Well, the track forecast has certainly gotten more confident. It looks like the core of the hurricane just stays offshore. However, we're still expecting 4 to 8 feet of surge and 5 to 10 inches of rain.
Well, I was going to ask you that. You said there's very little difference between hurricane rankings. People should still be vigilant, even if it's gone from a 5 to a 2, to see what surges, rain, wind.
Yeah, for sure. And it looks like the tropical storm force wind field has expanded. So what that basically means is that more areas will experience tropical storm force winds, even though now it's a Category 2.
Okay. Ray Hawthorne, meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. We've so appreciated you this week, Ray. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And now let's ring in NPR's Debbie Elliott. She's in Jacksonville, Florida, way up in the north on the Atlantic. She's monitoring Hurricane Dorian for the whole area. Deb, you tell us the winds have been picking up there. What's going on?
Yeah, it's beginning to start to feel like tropical storm conditions here. Very much gusty winds, some intermittent rain that started to pick up a little bit as this storm moves up the coast. You know, downtown Jacksonville is pretty much deserted. Most of the businesses were closed. The beaches were told to evacuate, and travel is now restricted, so you can't go on over the bridges that lead out to the barrier islands. Our curfew is also in place so that emergency crews can respond as necessary.
And it's not anywhere near, and it's not going to be anywhere close to what parts of the Bahamas went through. But what are you hearing?
Right. So, yeah, definitely not the kind of hit suffered in the Bahamas, which obviously is in crisis now. You know, here in Florida, it's mostly a sense of relief that the state has certainly escaped the worst because Hurricane Dorian is far enough offshore that it's not causing the problems that were once feared. Still, there are some effects. You know, more than 14,000 customers have lost their power. The waves are really churned up along the coast and pushing water up into some roads that would have otherwise been dry. Most people I've spoken with say they are remaining vigilant because this storm has been unpredictable as it made that slow move up the Atlantic coast. In Jacksonville, Jerome Owen says he has sandbagged his house as Dorian's impact is starting to show up.
We experienced winds and a lot of rain. I just hope it ain't too much rain. You know, flood the house.
Deb, we were reading reports of one man who was trying to shrink wrap his house, you know, with plastic wrap to just try to keep the water out.
I don't know about that.
And I don't know if that's going to work. But up the coast from Florida, other communities are preparing for what could be brutal conditions from Dorian. You know, as we just heard, concerns about storm surges, flooding. So what are officials in Georgia and North and South Carolina saying now?
Well, they're saying now's the time to get out if you're in an evacuation zone. You know, you want to get going before the conditions deteriorate. You know, millions of people have fallen under those evacuation orders. And at one point, all roads leading out were turned, you know, the contraflow on the interstates and highways just to get people out. You know, like you said, the biggest worry right now is flooding. Charleston and the South Carolina Lowcountry are certainly very vulnerable, as are the Outer Banks of North Carolina, with forecasters saying you're going to have this combination of up to 10 inches of rain as well as storm surge of 4 to 8 feet. And that threat will increase as the core of the hurricane moves a little bit closer to the coasts of Georgia and the Carolinas than we've seen here in Florida.
I know you've been collecting sound. What are you hearing?
You know, people are watching and worrying. You know, they've had a really long time to watch this storm because it did stall over the Bahamas, and they've seen how awful it was there. Neil Estroff of Savannah was watching Dorian's progression and trying to make that call whether or not he was going to evacuate. And it's kind of a hard decision. He's worried the hurricane might come too close to the Georgia-South Carolina border.
Truthfully, I would like for it to go out to sea so it doesn't affect any other humans. So I wish it would just head out and play with the fish.
Play with the fish. That's a thought. And we just heard there from somebody.
That's what everybody's wishing, yeah, you know, Robin.
Just go out there. Debbie Elliott, NPR's reporter in Jacksonville, Florida, monitoring Hurricane Dorian for us up and down the coast. Debbie, thank you. Stay safe.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, some big news out of Hong Kong today. Chief Executive Carrie Lam said the government will formally withdraw that extradition bill that sparked months of protests in the city. The legislation would have allowed Hong Kong residents to be sent to mainland China for trials. Abe Denmark is director of the Asia program at the Wilson Center in Washington. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, put this news in context. Why do you think Lam finally agreed, after all that we've seen, to formally withdraw this bill?
Well, we've seen months of protests happening in Hong Kong, and the intensity and breadth of these protests seems to be increasing, not decreasing, as I expect many in Beijing had hoped, that time is not allowing this frustration to dissipate, but rather it's building up more and more concerns amongst a lot of the protesters in Hong Kong. So it seems that the chief executive, Carrie Lam, and people in Beijing felt that by withdrawing the bill, they'd be able to take some of the pressure off of the government, try to maybe split some of the protesters between some of the moderates and the more radical people to try to get things a bit more calm, try to drive some division within the ranks. And it seems that so far that strategy has not seemed to be terribly effective.
Hmm. Do you think that the demonstrations will stop now that the bill has been withdrawn? There are other demands that the protesters have as well.
That's right. And my expectation is that the protests are not going to stop. There have been five demands that the protesters generally have been calling for, and withdrawing the bill was only one of them. So far, the reaction broadly among many of the protesters, many of the prominent protesters, has been that this is too little, too late. They're looking for several other concessions. And what a lot of analysts are looking at is October 1st. October 1st is an important day for the Chinese Communist Party. And it is an anniversary for mainland China. And there's a lot of talk amongst some of the protesters that this would be a big day for a major protest again in Hong Kong. So the strategy of trying to split the protesters, trying to take some of the pressure down among the protesters, that will really be tested on October 1st and to see if the protesting leaders can really draw up a big crowd again to see if the anger and frustration is still there, or if the government's strategy has been a bit successful in calming things down.
Well, and all along the fear has been that if the protesters go too far, that China will crack down in a perhaps violent way, more so than they already have with things like tear gas and rubber bullets, but that they would be even more violent than that. Do you think that if the protesters launched a huge demonstration on October the 1st, that very important day, that China would react in a way that it hasn't so far?
Well, that's, as you said, that's the fear, that we'll see another demonstration of the Chinese government using force against people within its country. And that's something that, of course, a lot of people don't want to see. The challenge that we have is that a lot of the protesters' demands, especially calling for an independent investigation into the crisis, especially including police brutality, removing the description of this protest as a riot, and possibly even democratic reforms for greater suffrage and voting rights amongst the people in Hong Kong, could be very difficult for the government of Hong Kong to accede to. So this may come down to a bit more of a confrontation. We may see an escalation in violence. It's certainly possible, but I think something that both sides would like to avoid. My sense is that Beijing would try to just let passions blow out. They see, I think, time is on their side, and hopefully from their perspective, that making a small concession here with withdrawing the bill would allow tensions and allow passions to die down a little bit, and hopefully, from their perspective, let them split the protesters and maybe go after some of the leaders after so much attention has moved elsewhere.
Do you think, in just the 30 seconds that we have left here, that over the next several years, based on what we've seen and what we've seen today, that Hong Kong is going to be more democratic or less democratic?
There's a fundamental challenge within the construction under which Hong Kong exists, which is called one country, two systems.
Right.
This idea that Hong Kong can exist within China, but with a separate, more democratic government. The challenge is that as China tries to assert more control in Hong Kong, as we've seen before, that's going to lead to more and more contradictions within Hong Kong.
That is Abe Denmark, the director of the Asia program at the Wilson Center. Thank you for joining us.
Today, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg became the latest Democratic presidential candidates to release climate change plans ahead of a marathon round of CNN town halls tonight on the climate crisis. Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Julian Castro, and Amy Klobuchar released their plans earlier this week.
Lots going on in politics, so let's bring in our political strategist. Republican Matt Mikowiak is in Austin. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
And Democratic strategist Maria Cardona joins us from Washington. Hi, Maria.
Hey there.
And let's first check in quickly on President Trump's response to Hurricane Dorian. Here he is in the Oval Office with emergency officials this afternoon.
We certainly got lucky in Florida. Now we can get lucky in Georgia. And if you look at South Carolina, North Carolina, but it could even extend beyond that. So we're talking about Virginia. Hard to believe.
If you look back over the last week or so of President Trump talking about the hurricane, Matt, he was first saying, will it ever end, about it going towards Puerto Rico? Then he talked about how it was going to hit Alabama, even though that was not part of the forecast. He did a lot of golfing as the hurricane was sitting off of Florida. What do you make of his response to this hurricane?
Well, look, he doesn't have a future in meteorology. I think you can say that. But look, I think as long as he's engaged, as long as he knows what's happening, as long as he's overseeing the federal government and, the resources are pre-deployed in the areas where they think it's going to be. Look, this is, at least in a prep phase, it's really more of a state and local responsibility, and the feds come in afterwards and try to help with the rebuilding. So, to me, as long as the governors are getting what they need from the federal government and they're not complaining about FEMA or other, state or federal agencies, I don't necessarily know that he needs to be, in an op center 24/7 working around the clock, particularly since the impact on the United States has been limited so far. There's obviously concern going forward about South Carolina and Georgia. So, look, I mean, maybe a little bit uneven. Certainly wish he wouldn't play golf in moments like this. But I also think it's important for presidents to get relaxation, given that their jobs are stressful. So I think we can be, a little bit of two minds on that.
Maria?
Well, I would say that his response to this hurricane, as his response to Hurricane Maria, was and are dismal. Perception is everything here. And when you're the president of the United States, you should be perceived as being worried about every single American citizen who is in harm's way. What I have a huge problem with is that his response to the 3 million American citizens that were in Puerto Rico when we thought that that was in the path of the storm was incredibly horrific. He essentially insulted Puerto Ricans, blamed the island for being in the path of the storm, and then went on to at least express some empathy, which I was happy about, when he knew that it had gone to Florida. And he expressed empathy not because it had missed Puerto Rico, but because it was on its way to Florida and he was worried about the people in the path of Florida. But look, overall, this is not a president who knows how to respond to national disasters or, frankly, to any disasters in an empathetic way. We have seen that time and again. The other issue I have with his response to this hurricane is that he supposedly did not go to Poland because he wanted to stay and be prepared and show the kind of leadership that we need from the president of the United States. And instead, he goes golfing. And so, again, the perception is that he doesn't care. The perception is that he doesn't understand. The perception is that he doesn't get it. And I think that in this case, perception is reality.
Well, Matt, I want to let you respond to any of that that you'd like to, but also add, you know, what Maria mentioned, the optics here. You say it's a state and local issue. It largely is. But the president is a symbol. And at this point in time, there's another symbol coming tonight with Democrats running for president who've released their climate crisis plans. There's going to be this big town hall thing on CNN. You know, is there something to be said? More and more Americans, polls show, more Americans can see with their own eyes the impact of the climate crisis. We have in the Oval Office someone who's been a climate science denier. Is that going to bite him at some point?
Well, you know, remains to be seen. I mean, climate change is obviously a very highly motivating issue on the left, particularly among younger voters.
It is
up to this point not been a motivating issue on the right. And the challenge with some of these climate change plans that have been put out is I think it's going to complicate the message Democrats are going to be able to offer in states that are energy reliant or that are energy producing. Certainly mm-hmm. Texas would be one example, but even states like West Virginia and states in the Midwest that have large, you know, coal deposits. So I don't know that it's a clear picture. I'd certainly think the public opinion is moving towards being concerned about you know, climate change and extreme weather. The question is whether these plans are going to make any difference globally, and if they're going to harm the U.S. economy without making much of a difference globally. I think that's a big question the Democratic candidates should be asked.
Well, Maria, let me ask you about that because, as Matt says, Democrats running have plans that will dramatically reduce or eliminate fossil fuels or make the U.S. economy carbon neutral or clean within decades.
Yep.
You know, is it too far? Joe Biden's plan, more modest, calls for eliminating fossil fuel subsidies, not the fuels themselves. Should this be more of a political concern now and then maybe wait till after 2020 to see if you want to push through those bigger plans?
No, I think that this is an immediate conversation that we should have been having way before now. We are seeing with our own eyes, with these hurricanes, with the strength of these hurricanes, the damage that we are doing to our own planet by not doing anything about climate change. And by the way, this is not an issue that motivates just the young Democratic progressives. The majority of the American people believe that climate change is real. The majority of the American people believe that our elected leaders should absolutely be doing something about it and that it is an existential crisis. So the Republicans and the right are going to be and are today on the wrong side of history here. And what I love about what we're going to see tonight from the Democrats is that, yes, there are a range of plans, but every single one of these plans focuses on climate change, makes sure that climate change is going to be one of the priorities for whichever one of the Democrats will win in 2020 and beat Donald Trump, and that from a leadership standpoint globally, that the United States is once again front and center. One of the most egregious things that this president did was take us out of the Paris Climate Change Accord, and I think that to the world has been a symbol that the United States, A, number one, does not believe in climate change anymore, and B, does not want to take a leadership position as we deal with this from a global standpoint.
Okay, Matt, the majority of Americans also believes in stronger background checks, and I want to ask you about guns, because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told radio host Hugh Hewitt yesterday that some kind of gun control could pass once Congress comes back next week, as long as President Trump supports it. Here he is.
If the president is in favor of a number of things that he has discussed openly and publicly, and I know that if we pass it, it'll become law, I'll put it on the floor.
Matt, what's your sense? Do you think that something will actually happen on the issue of at least background checks as soon as Congress comes back?
You know, it's never been a bad bet to wager against action on issues like gun control after mass shootings. The politics are challenging. I know that people like to point to these polls, and gun control advocates certainly think they have the wind at their back. But the politics is challenging. In order to have something actually become law, you have to have three things happen. A majority in Congress, which means a majority of House Democrats. You have to have 60 votes in the Senate, which requires bipartisan agreement. And then you have to have the president sign it. And so finding, you know, solving that Rubik's Cube in such a way that, that you're going to ultimately get something that will make a difference is really tough to do. You did see some action on fixing background checks on the Fix NICS Act a couple years ago, which did tighten up some things and improve some of the information that's there. It's pretty clear we need to go further. And I think this Odessa shooting may change the argument in moving toward background checks on private sales, particularly in this case where you had someone who failed a background check due to mental health issues in 2014 and then was able to apparently able to acquire a gun through a private sale. So, look, I think Republicans recognize they need to do something. Exactly what that is and exactly what the White House will support remains to be seen. But, yes, I do think there's a decent chance, maybe the best chance in quite a while, that they'll do something meaningful in September.
Maria, what do you think Democrats ought to do if they want to get something done right away?
They should continue pushing the fact that Democrats will support this, that the Democratic House will absolutely support this. The majority of the Democrats in the Senate, if not every single one of them, will support this. Again, the American people, the majority of the American people are behind this. I disagree with Matt. This is actually not challenging. It would be a lot easier if Republicans would get out of the handle and the puppeteering of the NRA, which is exactly what has happened every time Trump speaks up and talks about how he wants to see change in background checks. He promised this twice over through the last tragedies that we have seen on mass shootings. He promised the American people that he would work hard to do background checks. And then what happens? He has a conversation with the NRA and he backs down. Okay. That's exactly what he did now. Kind of leadership is not what we need.
We only have a minute left. Matt, I want to ask you, if you think there's a lesson for President Trump in what's happening to new British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his own party has turned on him, a conservative rebellion over his strong-arm attempts to have this Brexit breakup without a breakup deal to cushion the economic blow. He may be losing. Should Trump see anything in that?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's a bit of a different situation. Look, Brexit has vexed the British political system for several years now. It's taken down a previous prime minister. It's dividing the Tory party. And look, there's no consensus for a way forward. And Boris Johnson has said that the people voted and that a no-deal Brexit has to be on the table or else you get back to where Theresa May was, which really wasn't a sustainable position. I think this most recent reaction has to do with, dissolving Parliament early enough that Parliament couldn't take action to block a no-deal Brexit outcome. Okay. So I know that's getting in the weeds a little bit. Is there an analogy? I'm not sure I see much there.
Okay.
They do look sort of like each other. Both divisive issues. And they both won't be resolved anytime soon.
I think you can't hear us. Matt McCoviak, the Republican, Maria, the Democrat. Thank you. And so you say you're trying to get your Great Dane to herd sheep? Well, that might not be possible because your Great Dane's brain may not be wired to do that. And it could be because humans, maybe 1,000 years ago, didn't wire the brain to do that. Let's explain. There's a new study from scientists at Harvard University that looked at how dogs' brains were wired. Sharon Begley took a look for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Sharon, what were scientists looking at?
They were looking to see whether the behaviors that different breeds are known for had their origins in the brain. And, you know, the simple answer to that is yes, they have to, because the brain is the organ of behavior. But the question is whether the very, very different behaviors that different breeds are known for, you know, in your example, being really companionable or being a great retriever, you know, on all the other things that breeds are known for, whether the scientists could find a specific region of the brain and differences between breeds that might explain that. And, you know, when you say that, it seems like an obvious thing to look for because, of course, you know, if breeds are different in terms of their behavior, but nobody had thought to look for that.
I know. And the scientists expressed surprise to you, like, oh, we didn't know we might be the first. We don't, you know, somebody should have done this before. So they saw what? They saw that there were specific regions of the brain that so that a border collie had a place in the brain that made them better at herding sheep?
So what they basically found were six what they called networks, which are really just regions of the brain that are really, really strongly connected, that work together, etc. So, for instance, a network that includes regions that are really good at taste and smell and figure out the meanings of different tastes and different smells, you know, something that you might, that you, the dog, might perceive in the air. Those are really, really prominent in breeds that are known for outstanding hunting skills. One example is the German short-haired pointer. Another network is involved in interacting with people, and that one was really, really prominent in, for instance, the Bichon Frise, which is known for affection to its humans, etc. So the basic idea was to identify networks that have known functions and see, compare how robust they are across different breeds.
But then you also write that humans were a part of creating these brain spaces because they selected some breeds to do things and some not to, and thereby maybe what, helped wire the brains?
Well, that's what the scientists say, that humans have been shaping the brains of this other species for thousands of years. So dogs, or what became domestic dogs, evolved away from wolves about 20,000 years ago, and then for the last few thousand years, humans have indeed been applying selection pressure, as it's called, to dogs. So if you had, for instance, a dog in the Scottish Highlands that was really good at herding your sheep, then you would choose that dog to have puppies with another dog that was really, really good at that. And when you start that kind of selective breeding, then the trait that you're selecting for, whether it's, you know, physical, you know, long legs or a cute face, that becomes more and more prominent. And when you do that over and over and over again, then the differences between the dogs that you select to breed and the ones that you don't become really noticeable and really strong. So that's what the scientists mean when they say that humans shaped the brains of another species.
It's just fascinating. That's Sharon Begley from our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Sharon, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Valita Carroll is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. She joins us once again. Hi, Valita.
Hello, Jeremy, old friend. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to have you back. I remember the last time we talked, you were telling me about going out to parties past 6 o'clock in the morning in Ibiza. So let's see what you've got for us today. This is called Morena. This is by Addy. Say, I love that bass line that's going on underneath there.
It is such a beautiful cover of the famous Anina Sky song, Morena, and just the way she reimagines it, her voice is just so smooth. It's like butter, and it's such a feel-good song. I can't get enough of it.
And tell us more about Addy.
Addy is a local Los Angeles-based songstress, and she's relatively new. She hasn't been around. I mean, if you even look up the song, it's only got maybe like 50 plays on YouTube, which is how I love my music. DJs love discovering. Mm-hmm. And one morning I found the song in my inbox, and, we try to listen to everything that we receive, the DJs. So I just clicked on the email, and it's just a 4-track EP, and she said, you don't know who I am, but take a listen to Morena. I'm a local artist, and maybe you will like it. I think you will like it. And sure enough, I loved it.
Okay, well, let's get to the next one you brought us. This is This World is Drunk by Rafael Sadiq.
Look at this idiot. Don't know he's been set up to fall. Can't find a truth in any friend. And all he ever does is want drugs.
This world is drunk
and the people are mad.
This world is drunk
and the people are mad.
This world is drunk.
Ooh,
this world is drunk. This world is drunk and the people are mad.
So Rafael Sadiq put this album out in August after an 8-year break. Tell us more about him.
I've been a fan of Rafael Sadiq since his early Tony Tone days. I mean, he's just... come on. Not,
yeah,
you too, I'm
bringing
sure,
us
right?
Back, right.
Of course. And just to see where he went with this album, it's an homage to his older brother, Jimmy Lee. The album is called Jimmy Lee. And his brother had a very difficult life and ended up, you know, succumbing to addiction after a very difficult life. And this was him paying homage to just the way his brother was. So the entire record, every song, covers some aspect of Jimmy Lee's life. And this song is just... It's not really a... Well, it is kind of a departure from the party Rafael Sadiq that we know. There's maybe one or two songs that you can dance to on this record. But I really suggest that you listen to it from start to finish to get the whole experience.
Okay, the next one we've got from you is called I'm Free. This is by Soup Dragons. This is the Hi-Fi Sean Sunset dub version. So this was a well-known Rolling Stones song that the Soup Dragons covered back in the 90s?
Yes, so bringing it back to my river days again, right?
Yeah. Love
always
the 90s.
Always going back to the Ibiza. Yeah, I mean, I grew up with this song. This is how I, really one of my first introductions to the underground rave parties at the time. This was such a huge hit on the circuit. Hi-Fi, Sean, he is really great at remixing. And this label, Midnight Riot, did a whole compilation of Balearic remixes, just sort of like bringing those songs to a younger generation. And, you know, I love me a remix, an edit, anything that gets into that nostalgia realm for mm-hmm. me as an artist.
Well, and when we say it's a dub, what does that mean exactly?
It means that there aren't as many lyrics as in the original,
uh-huh.
so the song is a lot more sparse, so you can really hear, like, the bass is very prominent, and there's a lot more room for DJs to, like, mix in and out, and there's a lot more peak and valleys, and just, you know, time to be in your head, and just dance on the dance. I mean, it's a 7-minute song, so you can just imagine that there's a lot of music and not too much talking.
Okay. Well, the next one that you brought us is Midnight Choir. This is by Do Paulo.
In the garden, overgrown and disregarded.
Is there a nostalgia connection to this one as well, or no?
Oh, this is one of the... I just got chills, by the way.
Wow.
Just her voice and how she's able to connect with her listener. The song Midnight Choir is about that time at night when everything is quiet and you're alone with your thoughts and everything kind of comes in at once. And because I don't sleep... sleep very well, and I love to listen to music late at night. So this song really spoke to me, and just the harmonies in these songs are gut-wrenching. So this song is just like beautiful.
Well, we have time for one more, Valida, and this one is called You. This is by Nicole Buss. What a soulful voice.
Oh, gosh. Do you recognize the sample here?
Well, so it's Wu-Tang, right? Wu-Tang sampling.
Exactly. Yeah, but you know who Wu-Tang sampled?
Mm-hmm. Who?
The Charmels.
Okay, so layers and layers of sampling going on.
Layers of layers. And I just love that she actually pays homage to the original song, because in her lyrics, Nicole Buss says, "As long as I have you, babe." And then that's the actual title of the song, the Charmels song, "As Long as I Have You."
Wow.
So there's just, and the bass in this song, like, come on. Yeah, this one never leaves my repertoire. Every time I DJ out, you know, when the vibe is right, I just slip it in there and everyone just comes over like, who is this? Like, that sample, oh my God. It's so good.
That is Valida Carroll, who is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Valida, great to have you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And if you want to hear more, you can find it on our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
The government of Afghanistan is expressing new concerns about a possible peace deal with the Taliban that would end America's longest war. Afghan officials are agreeing with a group of former U.S. ambassadors to Afghanistan, who just yesterday wrote a letter warning that a full-stop U.S. troop withdrawal that doesn't require the Taliban to meet certain conditions could lead to total civil war. Lise Doucette is BBC chief international correspondent. She's in Kabul. Lise, the casual observer here might agree with those former ambassadors and Afghan officials, because wasn't the Taliban just behind a bombing in Kabul where you are?
There was a powerful explosion in Kabul on Monday night, so powerful that it shook the city. We could feel it, even though we were in the center of Kabul and the blast was in the east of the city. And it erupted just in the final minutes when the U.S. envoy Zalmay Khalilzad was speaking on Afghan television, talking about his hopes for peace and giving some sense of what he called a deal that had been reached in principle with the Taliban to move toward peace. So not surprisingly, many Afghans, and most of all those Afghans living in the area where the explosive set off by the Taliban went off and saw their houses completely shattered, said, "What do you mean the Taliban are interested in peace? Why am I suffering yet again?" But I think peace negotiators would tell you that it is often the case. It was in the case with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It was in the case with the Colombian peace process that adversaries often say, "We will wage war as if there are no peace talks, and we will conduct peace talks as if there is no war." Hmm. And that, many feel, is one of the weaknesses of this agreement that's been reached in principle. We understand it will call for a reduction of violence, but this violence, and it's devastating violence, not just in Kabul, but in many areas of Afghanistan on an almost daily basis, is really killing Afghan hopes for peace.
Well, I understand that the Taliban or a spokesperson, actually made a statement about the bombing and said that they had to show strength while they were, you know, having negotiations. And I'm wondering if part of that show of strength is for their own followers. I mean, what do you think is going on there?
The Taliban statement said they were targeting foreign forces, and yet, yes, they made it clear that Afghanistan was, and you know, they were still under occupation. And not just this bomb, but for example, last week there were major assaults on strategic cities in Afghanistan, including Kunduz, a provincial capital, which the Taliban have seized twice in the past. And many people on both sides were killed in that, including civilians. And we wondered, what is the purpose of this? Does it show that the Taliban movement is fractured, that there are those who do not agree with the Taliban who are negotiating in the Gulf state of Qatar? Or is it, and we think this is the case, that it is a show of military strength by the Taliban as they move to finalize an agreement with the United States, which is meant to pave the way towards Afghan talks, which are meant to chart a roadmap for peace and eventually a ceasefire?
Well, you're right. You remind us that this deal is about, you know, possible U.S. withdrawal of troops. The U.S. is looking, U.S. officials are looking for phased withdrawal. The Taliban wants all the troops out. And President Trump has said that on occasion. He wants full withdrawal. And some analysts are saying that that's hurt the U.S. negotiating position. If, you know, U.S. officials are talking about a phased withdrawal and Trump is saying take them all out, which is what the Taliban wants, it sort of hurts the negotiating. What's the sense there of that?
Well, I was in Doha for one of the rounds of negotiations and asked the Taliban about that. And I think the Taliban, like Americans, like people around the world, have come to accept that President Trump communicates by Twitter. And some days he says one thing and some days he says another. And it's not always consistent. In fact, the blazing front page headline of an Afghan newspaper when I arrived in Kabul was conflicting statements from President Trump. So for the Afghan Taliban who are negotiating, what matters to them is what they are hearing from President Trump's envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad. But what they absolutely know, and this is what people fear, is strengthening the Taliban confidence in these negotiations, is they know the United States wants to leave. And in fact, some say that some Taliban say, well, why should we negotiate at all? We know the Americans are going to pull out. Why don't we just bide our time? But if you talk both to the Taliban in Doha as well as to the American negotiations, they say, both sides say they accept that there is no military solution to this conflict, that there has to be a negotiated way out. But on the other hand, there are Taliban commanders in the field, and what they say now is that they're going to fight on. And that is what is really worrying people here, and why what you hear in Washington and what we're hearing now in Kabul as the Afghan government and Afghan leaders look at this draft document that Zalmay Khalilzad has brought. They're saying, let's just take a moment and let's make sure this is right and this is the right way to move forward.
Lise Doucette, BBC's chief international correspondent on the ground there in Kabul, Afghanistan. Lise, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.